Hi, it's Francis Lam, and welcome to our little mini baby podcast, Splendid Table Selects. So this is where we pull out some of our deep cuts, like the interviews that really surprised us or showed us something new or just helped to make us better cooks. We're supported by the employee owners of Bob's Red Mill. They make terrific whole grains and organic ingredients, from all-purpose flour to flaxseed meal to farro. And if you don't know farro, you should really check it out. I love it, and I'll tell you more about it later on. And I'll point you to a great recipe, farro niçoise salad. But here's today's interview. Michael Chimarusti is a chef who is a magician with fish. His restaurant, Providence, has been on the LA Times Best Restaurants list every single year it's been open since 2005. He has an East Coast-style seafood shack called Condi and Ted's, which is truly one of my favorite places to eat in LA. And last year, he opened a seafood market, Cape Seafood and Provisions. He's a chef who thinks deeply about fish, and our contributor Russ Parsons talked with him about how home cooks can use his techniques.
Michael Chimarusti, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thanks, Russ. Thanks for having me.
You know, Americans seem to be famously afraid of cooking fish, but we slowly seem to be getting over that. I think still most of us continue to use the same kind of handful of basic techniques. You know, we throw it on the grill, we saute it, we run it under the broiler. As a chef who runs two seafood restaurants and a fish market, you've got some interesting ideas about how we can do it better. So Let's go over a couple of them. I think they're interesting techniques.
Sure.
The simplest is probably brining. That's something a lot of us do for poultry or for pork. I'd never thought about brining fish, but it works wonderfully. So walk us through the process.
Well, there are two different ways. You can either do it wet or dry. So dry is the simplest way to do it. And dry, just, you know, sea salt on a fillet of fish. And then, you know, you let that salt sort of like rest on the fish until the fish begins to sweat so that, you know, it draws a little bit of moisture and draws protein up out of the flesh. And the fish will appear dewy at that point. And then you can wipe that off with a paper towel. You can even rinse it under a cold tap for a second and then let that fish rest for 6 hours, 8 hours. That's a great technique if you want to eat the fish raw for sashimi. It's delicious. And it creates like a seasoning that's through and through the fillet, which is really important. And it also keeps you from having to like season the fillet with finishing salt at the end. So you eat the fish, you definitely taste the salt, but it's... there's no specific source of the salt. It's just sort of there, you know, and that's really nice. And then if you're talking about a fish that you want to grill, like say, you know, halibut or something like that, or a snapper or a bass, depending upon the thickness of the fillet, you would brine the fish in a 5 or 7% salt solution. So that means for every 100 grams of water, you do 5 grams of salt. And somebody can do the conversion on that in terms of tablespoons and ounces. And it's not really that hard. But, you know, you depending upon the thickness of the fish, you would let the fish sit in that brine for, you know, an hour or two, or maybe even three or four, depending upon it. Like if you have, for instance, like a big albacore loin, which is something that we brine a lot at the fish shop for smoking, we let it sit overnight. But that's an extreme case because it's a big piece of fish. But then once you've brined the fish for a specific period of time, you pull it out, you let it rest. Even overnight is great, you know, and you don't wrap the fish at that point. You pull it out of the brine, you put it on a rack. You cover it with cheesecloth, not plastic wrap, and then just let it sit in the refrigerator. And it forms what's called a pellicle on the outside of the fish. And this is always the first step before smoking, whether it's hot smoking or cold smoking. But it also works really great if you just want to pan roast the fish or throw the fish on the grill or even, you know, poach the fish.
When you talk about a pellicle, what does the pellicle do? It's almost like a sticky coating right on the surface of the fish.
What does it
do in the cooking?
Well, in the cooking, what it does, it's sort of like it almost like seals the fillet in a way. It serves a different purpose in smoking. Like in smoking, it creates a surface that the smoke actually rests on. But when you're grilling a fish or cooking it in a pan, that surface sort of creates a barrier and it locks in moisture and it keeps the fish really, really beautiful.
Now that whole fish are becoming more and more available, you also like to roast them, like you would a piece of meat. Mm-hmm. So can you walk us through that part? That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, especially when we have larger fish, like we don't always necessarily do it on the bone. Like say, for instance, like during a service at the restaurant, if we have a salmon main course on the menu, what we'll do is we'll cook a large piece of the fillet of salmon that's enough for, say, 5 or 6 or 7 portions or however many we have coming up in a short period of time. So we'll put that fish on the grill or roast it in a pan in the whole state. And then once we've achieved like the color that we're looking for or what have you, we allow that fish to rest in a warm spot in the kitchen for a good long period of time. And, you know, even 30 minutes or 45 minutes greatly benefits the fish. And it allows the heat to pass through the fillet very, very slowly and very consistently. And then, you know, we slice those fillets, those large pieces, into portion-sized pieces that we then rewarm just briefly before we put them on the plate. And you're right, it is very much akin to like preparing a roast, like whether it's, you know, a whole roast beef or a rack of lamb or something like that. And when you apply those same theories to fish, you wind up with, you know, with different results, different textures, and a cooking that's far more consistent. You know, I feel like one of the most, you know, beautiful things about fish and is, you know, obviously they're all different in appearance and color and flavor, but they also have very different textures. And when you, if you apply the same techniques to every single fish, you wind up with textures that are very similar. And that sort of like belies the true nature of the fish. So, you know, we use in the restaurants, like different techniques for different types of fish to achieve a result that really kind of reveals what the true nature of that fish is, texture-wise, mm-hmm. and flavor, of course. And so, you know, and then at the diner, as you sit at the table, like when you pull that fish apart with a knife and a fork, you know, if you sear a fish really hard on one side, let's say in a pan, then flip it over and sear it really hard on the other side, it's going to have a texture that's not unlike, you know, a chicken breast or a steak that's been pan-seared or something like that. But if you just cook it very slowly and gently, or sometimes even cook it quickly but only apply heat to like one side, let's say the skin side of a fish, then when you get it at the table, the texture is very, very different and much more true to what it should be.
One of the big problems with seafood in America is that we still concentrate on like one or two species, you mm-hmm. know, shrimp, salmon, things like that. But those are getting scarcer and less sustainable.
And more expensive.
But there are lots of other fish, you know, little oily fish like sardines and mackerel. They're mm-hmm. plentiful, they're delicious, they're completely sustainable. What are some of the ways for a cook who may not be familiar with those fish to approach them?
Mm. Well, I mean, there's so many different ways. Like, you know, smaller fish like sardines and anchovies, like anchovies specifically, I mean, if you are going to cook them at all, you know, really the best thing to do is just like salt them and throw them on the grill and then just enjoy them that way. And it's almost true for sardines as well, unless you get really big sardines, in which case you might like fillet them or butterfly them open and you can cook them in different ways. Mackerel is sort of the same thing. I really love mackerel grilled. Like when we get what are called like tinker mackerel, which are smaller mackerel, we take them and we debone them and butterfly them open. Then we grill the skin side just briefly and then pull them off the grill, brush them with an herb oil. So at this point, the flesh has not been touched by any direct heat at all. Brush the flesh with a little herb oil, a little squeeze of lemon juice, and then we put breadcrumbs over the top of it and lots of extra virgin olive oil, and then just finish it in the broiler so it gets crispy and golden brown. But underneath it, you have that grilled flavor of the fatty fish and this beautiful like herb oil that's just a little spicy from red chili flakes. And it's like, it's incredible. And, you know, that's a fish that, you know, at the most it's going to cost you $5 or $6 or $7 in a fish market, but they're incredible. They're delicious. They're low on the food chain. They're plentiful. And, you know, but the unfortunate thing about that is that, yes, they're plentiful. Yes, they're inexpensive, but go and try and find one. A very difficult fish to find. And that's because it's a low value species. It's not worth a lot to the fishermen. And so you don't see a lot of them on the market, which is a real shame.
Yeah. You know, along the same lines, if you're somebody new at the fish market, mm-hmm. you see different kinds of fish. What are some of the ways that you can look at and think about, okay, here's how I'm going to cook this fish? Are there different textures? Are there different fat contents? Are there things that you can tell by looking at the fish that will help you determine how to best to cook it?
Mm. Well, I mean, let's be honest. Like, if you're a casual cook at home or even a serious cook at home, like, you're not going to have the kind of experience that somebody that works in a good fish market will have. So my advice is to just go in and ask questions, you know, what's looking good today, what's super fresh, you know, and then talk to whoever it is that's behind the counter about what you plan to do with the fish.
Now, as a chef at one of the country's best seafood restaurants, you can purchase the finest fish from anywhere in the world. And mm-hmm. for many, many years, that was the menu that you offered. But a couple of years ago, you became part of the Dr. Dish program here in Southern California that is buying mainly locally caught fish from small fishermen in Santa Barbara. What kind of fish are you getting, and how has that changed your approach to cooking? How has that changed your menu?
Well, it's changed the menu a lot. You know, I mean, right now we're doing everything that's on the menu is, with the exception of one ingredient, is from the Pacific seaboard. So we stretch that all the way up to Alaska and down to really Baja, you know. But we don't use that much from Baja right now except an occasional oyster. But it's changed things tremendously, and Dr. Dish really was the beginning of that. Through Dr. Dish, we get all sorts of delicious and underappreciated fish, like, you know, the many, many rockfish species that exist here in Southern California and actually all through California. So, I mean, things like vermilion rock cod, which is an absolutely delicious fish, or blackgill rockfish, which is another delicious one, long spine and short spine thorny heads, which are great. There's a fish called a fantail sole, which is a bycatch of the halibut fishery, which is like if you've spent any time on the East Coast, you've probably had flounder, you know, and that it's very much like that. Absolutely delicious and very mild and, you know, an interesting fish to work with. California halibut, California yellowtail, sheep's head. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Incredible Pacific mackerel from right here in Southern California. They're hook and line caught. Just delicious, you know. And these are all species that for years and years and years at Providence I overlooked. And part of the reason was that there are no, like, clear channels to get that fish from the small boat fishermen to restaurants. Like, the supply chains were built to handle, you know, the fish that we were talking about earlier, things like salmon, things like shrimp, things like tuna, high value species that are abundant, that are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And that's really what the market drives into restaurants like mine, you know. And obviously we sorted through all that stuff and we found the very best, and we would bring in stuff from all over the world. But the truth is, I found in the last several years that really the best fish I've ever worked with was right at my back door the whole time. It's just there was no clear and easy way to get it to our back door. So through several years of work and building networks and all that kind of stuff, you know, Dr. Dish has been able to, you know, bring really the best fish I've ever worked with to the restaurant, and it's being harvested no more than 100 miles away.
And it's interesting sometimes when you have the ability to choose from any kind of material, from when you've got, you know, the world is your palate, when you have to narrow it and you have to make hard choices about what it is you're going to cook, it brings out a different kind of creativity.
I agree. You know, I mean, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it makes such perfect sense. And, I mean, this is a... You know, this is something that's, you know, sort of started with people like Alice Waters way back in the 70s and then evolved through all sorts of people like Larry Forgione, who I worked for. And then, you know, I mean, guys like Rene Redzepi really took it to the extreme. The idea of localism, the idea that the food that's on the table should represent time and place and, you know, the times that we're living in and the place that we're living in. And I feel like, you know, we're probably doing that better now at Providence than we ever did. And I'm proud of that. And I'm happy that it's been done in a way that, you know, I don't know. You can see the impact of what we're doing, you know, and see the impact like in the lives of fishermen like Eric Hodge, who decided like, well, maybe I don't need to run this auto garage anymore. I can turn it over to my partner and I can fish more because there's a market for it now. That, I mean, to me, that's a great thing. You know, that's a, ultimately, I feel like, you know, that is, I don't know, I'm as happy about that as anything that I've ever achieved through cooking, you know what I mean? Because it's, you know, it's keeping American fishermen on the water. And if I had my druthers and had my life turned out differently, I might have wound up as an American fisherman, a commercial fisherman. I am a fisherman, but I don't do it for a living. But, you know, I could have been there, you know, I could have been that guy because it's one of the things that I love most. So I'm happy to be able to support people that do it for a living.
I mean, you're a Southern California cook now, mm-hmm. but you still got this Northeast thing going. So, I mean, we have to talk about chowder, right?
Right. First of all, it's a ubiquitous dish, right? You see it everywhere. But I, you know, I often feel like it's not given its due, you know what I mean? And I think the roots of what a chowder is supposed to be are not truly respected in many places. And, you know, at the end of the day, with something like chowder, simplicity and an elemental approach to it are the best ways to do it. You know, you just, I mean, a chowder should have potato. It should have some sort of pork product. It should have onion and it should have clams. And there's not a lot else that needs to be in there. And frankly, like when you eat a chowder, those are the things that make it great. So why, you don't need a whole bunch of other stuff. You certainly don't need flour. You know, you just allow the clams to, you know, speak for themselves and to flavor the broth and to flavor the potatoes and to pick up a little richness from the pork fat. And that's all you need, you know, and that's what, that's how we make it at the restaurant. You know, we started with very simple, you know, it's fatback, it's onion, it's, you know, the juice from freshly shucked clams, and lots of potatoes. And then we cook that as a broth, you know what I mean? And then by the time it's done and the potatoes are soft, the broth thickens a little bit from the starch in the potato. Then we pull that off the fire, we cool it down, and we let it rest. In a separate pan, we take lots of good fresh cream and reduce it from, say, a quart to a half a quart. And then in, you know, the following day, once that that chowder's rested overnight, you can either serve it clear as it is, which is a Rhode Island staple. It was like that dish was really created in Rhode Island, and it's still served on good restaurants today there. But if you want to turn it into an New England chowder, then you just add a portion of that cream that you've reduced by half into the clear chowder, and boom, you've got New England chowder. And that's honestly, that's all it should be. You know, just good, simple, wholesome ingredients. Because at the time where those dishes were created, it wasn't about purity or simplicity. It was about this is all we have. We have potatoes, we have onions, and we have clams. And we have some salted pork that from the hogs that we slaughtered last spring, you know, or last fall. And that's what it was. And to me, that was when it was probably in its best form. And so that's how we make it.
So what's gained by the overnight rest?
To eat it that same day, you don't get the full, I don't think you get the full effect. I think it's way better after it sits one night. And I don't know, the flavor just seems to be truer and more, has more depth and, you know, and it's more layered, more nuanced.
Michael Cimarosti, thank you so much for being on Splendid Table.
Thanks, Russ.
That was Russ Parsons talking with the chef Michael Cimarosti. Michael was kind enough to share two of his recipes, one for a killer New England clam chowder, which is like my favorite soup in the world, and the other for vermilion rockfish with braised artichokes and herbs. You'll find those recipes and Michael's video on how to make three kinds of chowder on our website, splendidtable.org. Splendid Table Selects is supported by Bob's Red Mill. They're employee-owned, which is always cool, and they have devoted themselves to making high-quality, whole grains, and other organic foods, like their organic farro. Now, farro is an ancient wheat, like ancient Rome ancient, and it's like barley, but nuttier and chewier. And I love cooking with it, and I just usually do it really simply. You just boil it in water or broth with some salt, and you just cook it until tender. You can chew your way through it, and you can decide, oh, I want this firmness. You know, it's totally up to you how tender you want it, but it's got a really forgiving window, so you don't have to be maniacal about it and, like, stand over the pot and be ready to get it out of the water the second it's done. And it's great warm with a nice savory dressing or under a braise. You can use it like a rice or like a pasta. Or you can check out Bob's Red Mill's recipe for farro niçoise salad, and that's at bobsredmill.com. I'm Francis Lamb, and thank you for listening.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.